You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hey guys, welcome everyone to the next installment of The Guidepost. I'm your guest host for today, Nick Jones, and I'm excited to bring you guys a really special guest, not just to the fly fishing community, but a special guest to myself. I've got a laundry list of really amazing stats and accomplishments here for an intro. I'm not even going to list all of them off because I'm going to wait to get into it with our guest. But this person is a pillar in the fly fishing community, with over 20 years of guiding experience, over 30 years of fly fishing experience, which includes fishing all over the planet, exploring, pioneering, promoting, establishing different fisheries, working with different gear manufacturers. The list goes on and on. It's pretty amazing. He's the managing director and one of the founding members of one of the most well-run, successful fishing outfits on the planet, unless you've been living under a rock the past long while. You've heard of them. I welcome to the podcast today, Keith Rose Innes. Thank you for joining us. This is awesome to have you.
Absolute pleasure, Nick. Yeah, nice to spend the time with you. And obviously, we have had some fun times in the past out in the Seychelles. And yeah, it'd be great to reminisce a little bit.
So Keith, where are you joining us today from?
Well, for my sins, I'm sitting in Johannesburg, South Africa. I go back to Seychelles a couple of days. We're obviously in the middle of our season, being our season runs from around September until the end of May. So yeah, it's all guns on deck at the moment, and all the different destinations are fishing really well, and all the conservation work that we're doing is all running well. So I get to come back and spend a couple of days with my family.
Love it. The family time is important. So before we get into the Seychelles, because there's a whole lot to unpack there. I know, you know, there's two groups of people here in the States. You guys have such amazing marketing. So, you know, there's a group that's really in tune with that marketing. So they know who you guys are, they know what you do. And there's a whole another group of people who couldn't even point to the Seychelles on a map. They have no idea what it is. So before we unpack that, I want to introduce our listeners to a little bit more about you and your background. You have an impressive resume in the fishing industry. And it's one that you can only get really being ingrained in the sport of fishing from a young age. It really is cool looking over everything that you've been involved in. So before we get into any of the Alphonse stuff, walk us through a little bit of your history with fishing, kind of how you came up as a kid and how fishing has really taken a hold of you and led you to where you are now.
Yeah, I think with any start in fly fishing, it all comes from somebody else. It stems from, you know, the family members or friends. And I was very lucky to have, you know, really good fly fishermen and fishermen around me as a young person. My grandfather was a really, really well-established fly fisherman, really well-known in South Africa, fly tie and Rhodesia. And my other side, that's my mother's side, my father's side, also the same thing. My grandfather, also quite really well known, and their family in the fly fishing realm, not from a commercial perspective, but just from a fishing perspective. So, you know, obviously having these people around me, I fished from a very, very young age, started trout fishing, and by sheer chance, I got invited on a trip in my late teens to the Seychelles with my father. And, you know, it was that reflecting moment of all the travels that I did before that I realized how amazing the Seychelles are. was, and that inevitably where I wanted to end up. So yeah, it's been a long road of guiding in Russia. I did 4 seasons there, starting in 2000, ending in 2004, as the head guide on the Panoi River in Russia. And while doing that, I was obviously doing other guiding around the world, obviously fishing in the deepest, darkest armpits of Africa, fishing for the biggest and craziest fish. Some of them never been caught before, and some of them never been caught before on fly. Some of those species managed to get, and some we didn't. So, you know, it's been an amazing experience. And I think, you know, if you get ingrained in fly fishing and you're privileged enough to work in the field of fly fishing, and as I was in the early days, it generally in an area that was largely undiscovered from a fly fishing perspective, I'm talking about Africa, there are so many opportunities that come along your table, and it's up to you to take those opportunities and go and see the places. So yeah, I've just been, I think, you know, when I reflect back where I am now and where I started more than 20 years ago, it's been sort of more luck than me actually going out and finding the places that I've been to. So if you're in it, you get offered, you know, other opportunities, I suppose.
Yeah, that resonates with me, the whole luck thing. We'll tell some stories later in the podcast, because luck, I think, has such a huge part to do with a lot of the good things that happen for people in life. But it's not just luck. You know, my dad always told me, like, you got to be good to be lucky type thing. So like, obviously the technical skill was there, and to have a mentor, I think everybody in the fly fishing industry, or most people who really get ingrained in it, have had a mentor, right? I know I had one. I don't know that I would know half of what I know now if I didn't have someone walking me through it. So luck, yes, but you know, you obviously had the foundation and enough technical skill that when you were lucky enough to get to go on those trips, you were able to take advantage of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, I've obviously had a lot of, you know, experience and sort of guidance from all sorts of people around me. You know, it wouldn't be any one person in particular. Obviously life choices, life decisions guide you on your path. You know, whether you decide to go on any particular trip or don't decide to go on that, if you decide to go east or west, you know, and therefore, you know, sometimes it is a flip of a coin. For me, you know, it's being a South African and growing up in South Africa, and sort of the path which we've been through, in the sense that we live at the point of Africa, and you know, it instills a little bit more of a little bit more of drive, and also a little bit more of an ability to experience pressure from a how can I say, from an operations perspective. Whereas, you know, massive sort of bumps in the road can be overcome purely because we're used to them. And I think that's why, you know, if you look in the fly fishing community, you don't have to look too hard to find really, really strong characters which come from South Africa. And all of them, you know, have done really well because they have that African drive in them, where, you know, big problems in other places around the world are small problems in Africa. We've got much bigger problems than what we're dealing with. So in that sense, I think, you know, it has given us a lot of drive to sort of not really say no to certain opportunities. And, you know, we've made the most difficult logistical places work through sheer blood, sweat, and tears, and continue to do it, you know, for the right reasons.
So with all the experience that you have, the guiding experience, the fishing experience in general, what are some of the places around the planet you've been to, and what are some of the standout places that really captured you, that kind of fed that drive to keep learning and keep going?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was, you know, learning how operations run in vast, in sort of remote areas. Like, I learned how to run operation in Russia, you know, that, in Panoy in Russia, you know, vast, far away, very difficult to operate, but it happened, you know. So that was a very key moment in my life where I learned a lot. And not only learned a lot, but, you know, admired the people that were there, hardworking people that were there. And also the conservation work by hook or crook that was in place, you know, the removal of the kiting fences and so forth, and the significant scientific work that was going into that destination and would be obviously portrayed to the guests on a weekly basis. So, you know, that was a fundamental sort of experience that I had that sort of gave me a lot of drive to focus on the same kind of experience. But I mean, there's obviously, you know, I spent crazy amounts of time in places which I never even saw a fish. But real places which stick out, you know, which are amazing, are places like Tanzania, Manyara River, Ruhudji River for massive target fish. Like places like Cameroon, you know, you're fishing a tiny little river for massive Nile perch and all sorts of other species. You know, and then you obviously get, you know, up into Russia and the east coast of Russia, those in the Tugur area, those massive, you know, 100-pound taimen that are eating fish that are 60 centimeters long, you know, and then obviously, you know, the salt water and you know, my passion is Seychelles, you know, the sheer variety of fish that I offer, and you know, the fact that each one is very different and they're all different characters, and you can walk down a flat and you can experience so many different things and species of fish in within 5 minutes. And that's what keeps you on your toes, and that's what I enjoy so much. But not so much anymore. You know, I think, you know, as life progresses, I think you're not so much driven about by the catch, but more about the vastness and the nature around it. You know, places like, you know, up in Bolivia, you know, places, you know, also other places around the world which are really vast. Bolivia, and pristine. You know?
Bolivia is on my list. It's one of the top spots on my list to go see. The Golden Dorado thing has captured my imagination, kind of like the Seychelles did when I went out there. It has that similar feel of being so wild and the idea of catching these big, aggressive fish. I think if you talk to a lot of fishermen from the United States, they all have some sort of a base history working on rivers, right? Or not working rivers, but fishing on rivers, right? Because a lot of our fisheries, you know, we have the saltwater fisheries, but, you know, there's as big a part of the country inland that fishes on rivers. And all those same rivers empty out in the saltwater anyway. So everyone has some sort of experience. So the fish that we're used to seeing in these rivers are nothing like, you know, the stories we hear about. A fish like a Golden Dorado, for example, it has all the hallmark characteristics of a huge predatory saltwater fish, but lives in a confined river that will eat big brush flies and jump and is a nasty fighter, and they're powerful. As soon as you said Bolivia.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Nick, so from a, you know, obviously I love steelhead fishing, I love salmon fishing, you know, and for different reasons. But, you know, these, like, as you mentioned, Bolivia and Tanzania and Cameroon and those places, these are predators, you know, so they're not fish which are anadromous, you know, in a sense, you know, they are fish which are there to eat, to feed really hard. So I think that adds a bit of excitement. Whether it makes it easier or not, I think it makes it easier from a bite perspective, but from a perspective of holding on to them, it makes it a little more difficult.
Yeah. Well, it only adds to the mystique too. So you have a history with big fish, especially with, well, before we get into talking about the Seychelles, you know, if you could pick one fish there that really encompasses everything for you, that really drives it home, what would that fish be?
Well, it has to be the giant trevally. You know, he's the apex predator of the Seychelles. You know, he swims with the sharks. He eats with the sharks. He doesn't hold back when there's sharks around. You know, he swims around the flats, the shallow flats, with his pectorals out. You know, he's the man kind of thing. So, Yeah, and every one of them are very difficult. I mean, a lot of people think that, you know, I just go to the Seychelles and then cross the flight of GT and you're going to catch him. Well, it's not like that. You know, GT is a fish. You know, he is as susceptible to all the different aspects as a permit is, you know. So make the wrong noise, do the wrong move, cross to the wrong place, have the wrong fly, you're not going to eat it.
Can you recall your first experience catching a GT when you first went? Was that on that first trip you went out there with your dad as a teenager?
No, so my first time I caught a giant trevally was in Mozambique, very young. And I remember I was fishing with a New Zealand killwell rod that I think was an 8-weight and had been taken off by a fan. And so it was basically 3/4 of a rod. And I had a 2-to-1 gear ratio salmon reel with a sort of 14-weight blue, I can't remember the name of the fly line, but it was horrendous. Casting, you know, mustard hook, flashy kind of fly. And I caught some small giant trevally in Mozambique. But my first significant giant trevally experience was seeing them around St. Joseph's in the early days. But I'd say my biggest and first wake-up call of a giant trevally was in Farquhar. And that was in the early days. There was, I think there was around 2000, somewhere around there. But, you know, prior to that, it was still a new species in the Seychelles. You know, people were coming to the Seychelles. They were targeting bonefish. So the hotel in Alphonse, which was actually the pioneering fly fishing outfitter, there were two operations. That was around 2000. The hotel started. So yeah, very very fond memories of that first giant trevally. Not all of them for the right reason, you know, tackle failure and seize reel and hold on for dear life, but still got the fish.
So since that first one, and then after this, we're going to get into Alphonse because I have a feeling a lot of these stories are going to center around Alphonse, and I know that this is going to take some unpacking for a lot of our listeners because I know a lot of them couldn't even point to a map to see where Alphonse is. So before we start describing the physical place and how to get out there and your guys' operation and what it's all about. So since that first GT in Mozambique, I mean, that was a long time ago. If that was before you were a teenager, as a kid, you know, between that span and now, how many interactions, whether it be guided or self-caught, would you say you've had with giant trevally?
So I used to have a book which I kept a tally of every giant trevally that I guided. You know, I obviously in the early days, you know, when we were guiding, we didn't have so much free time. So I'm sad to say that I guided a significant GD before I'd caught one. So, thereon, you know, I used to mark down in my book, you know, every single trip, every fish and so forth. But sadly enough, you know, I'm not sure where it went, but I lost the book at about just over 3,000 guided GTs. And that was a long time ago. So I did 17 seasons in the Seychelles guiding. You know, obviously in the early days of the pioneering stages, I was doing the pre-season sales. I was doing the client liaising. I was doing the hosting on location plus the guiding. And in those days, you know, we would do liverboards. So we would only have 10 guests, but we'd only have sort of 3 guides. Originally in the beginning, we would have 8 guests and 2 guides. So it would be 4 guests per guide. And then obviously a couple of years later, we sort of brought us up to 3 guides and then, obviously, you know, ended up, you know, where we are now with, you know, 1 or 2 guides per client. So, yeah. But I would say, yeah. I would say it's over 3,000 guided GTs at least. Yeah. So whether it's 4,000 or 5,000, I can't tell you. Yeah.
Well, and you know what? The number's unimportant. The point is, yeah. You are, I would say, the expert on large GTs. I don't know that there's many other people on the planet that have the same resume. You have an unbelievable amount of knowledge with these fish. I was blown away when I first went out there, learning myself. And a lot of what I learned was like a sponge getting soaked up through being around all of you guys. And you were kind of at the center of that, you know, the stories that all the other guides would tell. So I don't think the number is as important. The point is that you are one of the experts on these big fish, not just with catching them, but, you know, going through the arc of learning about the fish itself. Like you said, catching that first one on a broken down 8-weight, you know, with the 14-weight fly line, like trying to figure all this stuff out has gotten you involved in the gear side of things to the point where, like, tell us about the gear and how it developed and how you kind of had a hand in figuring out what the best tools were for targeting these fish.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, Giant Trevally tackle evolved as tackle evolves. We started off with Dacron, or as you were saying, I think you call it Dacron backing, which was, I think, close to 30 pounds. Your standard fly lines. And, you know, you could only utilize and use what you could find, you know, and as Gamagatsu came on the scene, and as Airflow started making stronger lines, and different fly line companies started making different lines, and different fly rod brands started making stronger rods, you know, so we sort of evolved. But I think now we've kind of, like, you know, in the earlier days, it was more about refining what you could get. Using knots which would withstand that kind of the pressure for that kind of tackle. But now, obviously, we fish between 11 and 12 weight rods for the Giant Trevally. We have, you know, 50 pound core lines. You know, there's companies which do welded loops now, which can survive the onslaught of a Giant Trevally. I'm still a bit old school. I do like to cut my loops off and put braided loops on, because I know that they will withstand a little bit of coral. So I think it's just evolved, you know. You know, obviously, we played a part in assisting with line tapers and rod tapers and real structure and design and so forth. But inevitably, it was the tackle brands that did the evolving of the tackle. We just kind of adapted it to Giant Trevally, you know, using certain knots and so forth. But I think the key element around making sure you're successful in landing Giant Trevally always pivoted around the points and joins. So the point between the fly and the leader, the point between the leader and the fly line, the point between the fly line and the backing. And that was the section of the Giant Trevally which we had to sort of work on and evolve and perfect in a sense. The rest was the tackle brand.
So that's really where my education with Giant Trevally started. When I first came out there to start guiding, doing the tackle setup at the beginning of each week, the guests would come in, we would get all their gear, and we would dissect everything, right, to make sure that it was up to snuff. I didn't understand that at the time because I was brand new, but, you know, the other guides, they knew all the ins and outs of what the best practices were for dealing with these fish. So learning the knots, especially at all the connection points, was so foreign to me. And at first was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, what do you mean take the loop off the fly line? Like, what do you mean cut the fly line? Like, why would you do that? The loop's there. Like, it's built for it. And they're like, no. These loops are not built to withstand the kind of pressure that these fish will put on it. It's like, holy shit. Like, it was Jurassic Park to me. When I first went out there, it was honestly a Jurassic Park moment. The only other time in my life I've had the same feeling was when I first started guiding as a spearfishing guide down in Southern Baja, where underneath the water was truly like Jurassic Park. Big fish everywhere. It was chaos. And that's what the flats on Alphonse were like to me when I got out. It was, and GT were central to that, right? They get the most, they get the most marketing. They're obviously the biggest, baddest, meanest, you know, require so much attention and finesse. There's so much that goes into it. It's not just hooking the fish. It's landing it too. And I had a couple experiences myself where we broke fly lines in the belly from just a fish pulling so hard on a fly line. And that's so foreign to us in the States here because we don't have fish like that can do that, or, you know, we're starting to tap into some different species now, but that's eye-opening. It's wild. So, you know, we're starting to talk a lot about Alphonse now. So for the listeners who are constantly hearing this, you know, you've probably seen videos, photos. Your guys' marketing has been stellar, but I think a lot of people don't even know where it is. So I'm going to kick this off and say, when I first heard of it, I couldn't have pointed to the Seychelles on the map. I was that American that, you know, my geography outside the normal areas of the world, think, you know, Europe, different parts of Asia, I couldn't have picked the Seychelles out on a map. I had to look up how to spell it. It was all very foreign to me. So, but tell us, Keith, before I describe what the process is like for an American to get out there, where is it on the map?
Yeah, so I mean, Seychelles is situated just north of Madagascar. So Madagascar is a massive island to the east of Africa, the southern part of Africa. So it's about midway, just below midway. It's below the equator. So it's, you know, Alphonse is about 7 degrees south. Seychelles is a small place. You know, it has, you know, 90,000 people that live there. It has 115 islands. It's very diverse in the sense that, you know, the further south you get, the more sort of coral orientated you get. So the more north you are, it's more sort of a granite, higher sort of granite sort of islands with big mountains and so forth. And then when you get go south, you know, you have coral atolls. Now, the difference between, you know, normal atolls and a coral atoll is that this atoll is actually made from coral. So what it is that, you know, millions of years ago, there was a volcano. The volcano subsided into the ocean. And as the volcano subsided into the ocean, the coral grew towards light. So, and as the coral grew towards light and the heavy matter of the volcano disappeared, that coral buildup remained. And so what happened is that obviously you get the deposits of sand, and obviously sand coming through the parrotfish and so forth, and different kinds of fish, which eat coral and break it down into white sand. And that sort of forms the islands, and then you get the growth on the islands. So there are coral atolls, you know, and really, really beautiful. And when we refer to an atoll, you know, it's obviously it's not one island most of the time. It's numerous islands. So you can have an atoll that can have one island, or you can have an atoll that has 50 islands, a lagoon. The referral to an atoll is, the definition of an atoll is a lagoon surrounded by reef. So it has a lagoon which is surrounded by flats in a sense. And you know, those white sand deposits is what makes these places so pristine and beautiful, and you know, really, really special when you actually take your wading boots off and put them on those white sand and walk down targeting any kind of species, you know. So yeah, it really is. They really are beautiful.
Yeah, it's a special place for so many different reasons. So to help paint the picture of how wild these atolls are, not just the atolls themselves, but how foreign it is for us from the States. Just to get out there is a 2.5-day trip. It's an involved travel process. So the two times I've been, because I've been, so for the listeners, I was lucky enough to get the guide out there for a season. It was, you talk about luck, Keith. I didn't deserve the opportunity to go out there. I was so young in my guiding career, and I wasn't even an ounce of the saltwater fisherman that, you know, I'm sure of the people from resumes you get. But I was lucky enough to get invited. And it was through the recommendation of somebody else. And I couldn't be more thrilled that you guys took a chance on me, because it was the most formative, you know, moment in my fishing life. I learned more than most people pack into a lifetime of learning about fly fishing. I was humbled every day. I was at the bottom of the totem pole, and I was a sponge. And I was fine with that. You know, I've made it a point to surround myself with people who are better than me in every aspect of life, because it's how I, you know, slowly get better myself. And Alphonse was a perfect example of that. I was surrounded by experts in every sense of the word when it came to fly fishing, and I was nowhere near that. So I appreciate you guys for taking the chance on me, but even to get out there. So I've been out there twice, one for a guide season at Alphonse, which is one of your main outposts for the lodges. And then once out to Farquhar, which I've got stories from that because that was another once in a lifetime opportunity to get to experience. For those of you who've seen the Blue Planet footage of the giant trevally eating birds off the surface of the water, that's at Farquhar. It is truly Jurassic Park. There's no other way to describe it. It's otherworldly. So I'm getting distracted. So to even get out to these islands, it is an involved travel process. So the first time I went out there, I flew from Minneapolis, Minnesota. So went from Minneapolis to Boston, Boston straight to Dubai, Dubai to Mahé in the Seychelles, and then the Mahé is the main island that you would fly into. So for all their trips, everything goes through there. So you get to Mahé, you're, 8 hours, different time zone, jet lag, nervous anticipation, excitement. You check into the hotel there, so you have at least a little bit of time to decompress and get your bearings, have a handful of cocktails, more times often than not, too many. And then from there, you take a smaller charter plane out to the atoll that you're going to. Now, to expand even further on that, some of the atolls you can't even get to by plane. So you've got to take a plane to one spot and then a boat from that spot to the other spot. So for us in the state here, it's as much as part of the adventure of actually fishing the flats there is getting to and from. I think most people in the States don't go through Dubai. I think most Americans, when they travel, unless they're doing business there, I wouldn't say that's top of the list for people to go visit. So it routes people through these wild places that they might not otherwise go to. And it truly is crazy. So even getting out there is an adventure. But once you get there, it really is hard to articulate how cool it is. So I don't want to steal all the thunder of talking about this, because I've been doing it since I left there in 2019, telling stories. I think if you ask a lot of my friends, they'd be like, dude, shut up. Like, every story you tell that has to do with fishing somehow starts with when I was in the Seychelles. And I know it's annoying. I get it, but I can't help it, because it really is that impactful. It's that powerful. It's that captivating. It's a special place. And I want to get into why that's so special. So I have my perspective, but you are an expert. So I want to hear from you about the different species you guys can target out there and kind of what makes it such a well-rounded fishery.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, being in South Africa, everywhere is far. So Seychelles isn't far for me. It's the one place. But, in the modern day world, anything that's good is difficult to get to. Unfortunately, we've ruined all the places that are easy to get to. So, obviously that's why it's a key element of why, we want to keep these places pristine. But, really about the Seychelles and the different atolls in the Seychelles is that they're all very different. I can run through some of them. So, starting with the closest destinations we have, I'm talking from Mahé and running in a southerly direction, and I'll talk in flight time. A half an hour flight is the Amaranthus Islands, and in the back in the days, it would have had a lot of giant trevally, but obviously over the years, it's been affected quite a bit by conventional fishermen, and the fish are shy if they are there. But I'm talking about giant trevally, but the permits are there, and there's a lot of great permit fishing. And if you know the destinations, because it is very tidal dependent and atoll and island specific, you can have incredible amounts of shot. So starting at Amaranthus, which is a permit destination, and with some bonefish, 100%, you can have the best permit fishing, Indo-Pacific permit fishing, the best Indo-Pacific permit fishing you've experienced anywhere in the world. It can be really, really good. they're moving more south from there, you know, obviously, you know, and this kind of, these are, this is the way the atolls kind of opened up because it was accessibility. You know, the closer you were to Mahi, you know, it was easier for you to operate them from a liverboard perspective. So as we move to more south, we get to Alphonse. Now, Alphonse in the early days had nothing to do with me. They were completely different operators. There were two operators, and once they built the hotel, there were two operators with four or six rods competing against each other. You know, obviously the hotel was built in 1999 and opened in 2000. So a lot of that pioneering work with certain species happened with the Alphonse guards in that period from about 2000 to 2001, 2002, 2003, there in that period. And obviously you have the milkfish, which was ticked off. And that was a combination of Honor Mathieu and Wayne Haslow. They both will tell a different story of who got it right. But obviously, you know, the first client to land a fish was with Honor Mathieu. But I mean, you know, that's the beauty about these destinations. They have so many different stories. And then so let me tell you about Alphonse and the fishery. So Alphonse as a fishery is a complete fishery from a species specific. The only species we don't target and don't have is the bumphead parrotfish. We have them around the atoll, but they generally stay in deep water. It is an incredible bonefish destination. More bonefish in the St. Francois Lagoon than anywhere in the Indian Ocean, by far. And obviously, having so many bonefish, it filters onto all the other predatory species like giant trevally and barracuda and so forth. So we have those in good numbers as well. But also the lay of the land, it is the only place in the Seychelles that has a 5-star barefoot luxury lodge that you can take anybody to. You know, it has all the comforts in the world, but barefoot comforts, and has this amazing fishing so close by. 5-star fishing. So it is the destination which catches more milkfish on fly than anywhere else in the world. Actually, all lodges around the world put together. It is a destination where, you know, the Indo-Pacific permit numbers increases and has, you know, increased year on year. We actively target the Indo-Pacific permit there. So it's the one place in the world where, you know, you can get a golden grand slam, which entails a permit, bonefish, two different triggerfish species, milkfish, giant trevally, and you know, any of those species, five of them, is a golden grand slam in our terminology. So it has all the species. Yeah, it really is amazing. So it really is like, you know, if you want to come and experience the Indian Ocean, Seychelles for your first time and have the ability to target all the species under the watchful eye of an experienced guide, it is a destination. It definitely is your stepping stone into the Seychelles. And I would recommend it as your first stop.
How many golden grand slams have there been?
I believe there's only been three.
so crazy.
And funny enough is that the first one was my business partner and the two of us founded the business, Murray Collins. He had a couple of drinks around the bar in one evening, and he decided that, you know, who has caught, you know, these five species in one day? And he said, you know what, if somebody catches five species in one day, we'll give them a free trip. Well, anyway, about a week later, somebody went out and did it. So we then canceled that whole thing with the free trips on the spot, free trips for golden grand slams, because we thought, no, we'll open up a kettle of fish here for everyone to go out, and we're not going to be able to sell any weeks because everyone's going to be chasing golden grand slams, you know. So, We then passed on that, but since then it's happened three times, two times, so a total of three times. Yeah, so it really, so, really yeah, is.
It doesn't need to be said. It's rare. It's difficult to put some perspective on this, and I'm not the world's best angler, right? Like, some of the people you get coming out there truly are world class anglers who have the technical skill to accomplish this, and it's more just, do the moves they make convert and line up with them actually getting the shots right? Because the, you know, before, a technical skill is one thing, but you have to be in front of the fish, you know, maybe multiple times in order to make it happen. So to add a little perspective to this, I was the laughingstock of Alphonse for probably my first 6 months there. So at the beginning of each of the seasons, they, as a new guide, you know, they told us this thing where, okay, like everyone, you gotta let your mustache grow and you can't shave it until you catch a mustache triggerfish. Now, these mustache triggerfish are, I would say, very tricky to catch. I had zero luck. I would, you know, it took me a while to figure out how to fish to them. And then once I did, once I got them to eat, they have human-like teeth. Where if you look, well, it's actually not on not on our social, but there's, you can look at a picture online and you can see their teeth, and it really does look like a mouthful of human-like teeth. So I was having it where I'd hook them in the teeth and come tight and have the fish on my rod and be so excited, and then they'd open their mouth and the hook would fall right out. Or, you know, their jaws are super powered. I'd have it where they'd bend the hook out or just bite the hook in half. It was infuriating. So it took me the better part of 6 months to catch one of these fish. So if you can imagine, you know, for the listeners, you can't see me right now, but I've got an afro and I get a hairy face if I don't shave. So my mustache, by the time I caught my fish, was gross looking. And it was honestly, it was like a point of conversation with new guests that would come here. Like, what's up with this one guy? Like, why is he so weird? Like, everyone else is so nice and clean shaven and looks sharp and looks good. And there's this American kid who looks like Yosemite Sam. So it took me the better parts of 6 months to catch one of these fish. So the fact that people would go out and in a single day be able to knock out five of these species is so truly impressive. It's something to really hang your hat on. It's outside of my comprehension.
Well, I mean, it's not common not to see all the different species in one day and have shots of them, you know, and have multiple shots of them. Now, it's obviously converting. So, you know, in any one day, if you're fishing to triggerfish, you will see moustache triggerfish. You will have shots of moustache triggerfish. You'll have shots at a yellow margin triggerfish and Picassos as well. You'll have shot at milkfish. You'll have shots at permit, giant trevally, barracuda. You know, it's obviously, you know, they don't always convert. And, you know, it's the luck of the draw. And obviously right at the end, you're generally looking for the bonefish right at the end. You know, you've caught all the other species on the low tide. Now you're looking at a high tide for a bonefish. And sometimes that can be the species you don't get, you know, end up with four. But it's an amazing place in the sense that you get those opportunities. So from Alphonse, then moving, sorry, keep going.
No, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Let's keep going down
from
the list.
So Alphonse, let me just obviously give the listeners a bit of information on basically how Alphonse looks. Yeah. So Alphonse is a standalone island, and then it has two atolls very close by. So in the morning when you go out fishing, you jump on a foster boat and you go across to the atoll, which is uninhabited, never has been inhabited, and is vast and pristine and has never had any kind of dwelling on it. So you fish that for your periods, your period that you are on Alphonse. Now, all the other destinations, you know, when you go further south, for instance, Cosmolito, you'll stand on an island that is in the atoll. So when we move south from Alphonse, we get, you know, Providence. And now Providence is a liverboard operation. We have a really luxurious catamaran, which we base there, big catamaran, 75-footer. And we fish it from a period, which is January or until mid-March. And the reason why we fish during that period is because the wind generally comes from the north, northwest. And basically you get, you know, we get to fish the opposite side of the atoll. Now, Providence is very well known for all different species. You can catch, you know, significant amounts of bumpheads. It has all the offshore fishing. It has milkfish. It has triggers, permit. And lots of giant trevallies. The one place that it does not have a lot of is bonefish and permit. So it generally is a destination where you'll catch a few of those if you target them. But it's not a destination where you go to target those. You go to target your bumpet parrotfish, giant trevally, Napoleon wrasse, milkfish, and all the other wonderful grouper species and so forth that you get there. And then going east south from Providence, you get Farqua. Nick, that's where you've been to, Farqua. It is the destination which we learned how to catch bumpet parrotfish. It is a destination where I was the first guide to take guided trips to, or fly fishermen to, in 2001. And I obviously cut my teeth and learned a lot of my lessons there. It's a destination which is actually, in the past, was affected by a lot of conventional fishing. But through the last 5 years of conservation and reestablishing guidelines and not allowing conventional fishing at this destination, it's now come back to an amazing place. Back in the days, in my early days, I was the first guy to see the giant trevally eat a bird. And I remember the day when I took guests to a place called Grillette. And I was guiding three guests, and I still remember the client, Australian client, I was guiding, and it was in November, in October, so it was at the tail of the sooty tern nesting, so there weren't so many juveniles around, but unfortunately on a back cast, this guest hooked a bird, and the bird was kind of line wrapped in a sense, and it landed in the water, and a giant trevally out of the depths came and just engulfed this bird, and he was obviously attached to the giant trevally for a while until it all came unraveled and we lost the fish, and that was basically the penny dropping. And I was like, I've seen all these splashes around me, but to the naked eye, it's very difficult to see it. Unless it happens very close to you. And I'd only been there for a few times to Goulet. And then I went back to the there was a small amount of locals living on the island, I think three or four. And I said to them, have you ever experienced this? And no, they've never experienced that. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I might be one of the first people to see it. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I definitely was the person who went back and mentioned it the most. And since then, the GD population has exploded, really good GD population. All the other species are there. But then if you want to sort of experience the GD capital of the world, you have to then move from Farqua. You have to move in a westerly position to our places called atolls, which we fish at, called Stove and Cosmolito. At Cosmolito, we have a eco lodge, which is made from containers, converted containers, really, really comfortable. The main area is a tent on the beach. But very, very comfortable, glamping in a sense. And the accommodation, what we call eco pods, insulated, hot and cold running water, outside tented area for a shower, front tented area for veranda and so forth. And then basically on the beach, as if it's almost washed up. Now, the beauty about Cosmolito is that we're able to remove all the infrastructure without leaving anything else behind, but the small runway which was built for safety perspective, if there's a medevac or so forth. But in order to get there, you have to first fly to a Stove, and then we boat you across to Cosmolito. Cosmolito is vast. It is the destination that has landed the most giant trevally over the years by far. To give you an understanding, is our record week, which happened about 3 years ago, was around 290 GTs. Our opening week this season was 260 odd GTs. So it can vary between those amounts of GTs all the way down to 30 GTs. It all depends on what's happening, weather, tides, what's happening offshore with regards to bait. At the end of the day, giant trevally is like any other fishing. They can be there, they might not be eating. They might not be there because of the weather, or the weather's not good enough for you to be able to target them and so forth. But generally, if you go giant trevally fishing in Cosmolito, you will catch one. But over the years, Cosmolito has been synonymous with all the other species as well. It's got an incredible triggerfish fishery, wonderful milkfish fishery, and obviously a really big bonefish. But it's also really well known for the ecology of it, the ecosystem, and it's got the biggest seabird colony in the Seychelles by far. And it just really is a special place. It's frozen in time. It's like, you know, the Galapagos of the Indian Ocean in a sense. Really, really is amazing. And then obviously from there, close to that, running from an easterly position, we have a very small easterly direction. We have a very small atoll called a Stove. And most of your fishing is done on foot there, you know, because the atoll has a really sort of small gap in it, which allows the volume of water to move up into the massive lagoon, shallow lagoon. So all the predatory fish have to pass that small sort of 120-yard gap. So really is an amazing place. And it is a destination which is synonymous with Jacques Cousteau. It has a famous place called The Wall, where you can be standing in knee-deep water, and within 20 yards from you, there is, you know, a sheer drop-off to over 500 meters of water. So it is, you know, all these destinations are very, very different. They're all remote. They're all spectacular for their different reasons. So, you know, the guests that have been coming to us for decades have had the chance to go to all the destinations. And generally it is a stepping stone kind of experience where you come to Alphonse, you have an amazing experience. You dip your toe in the experience of, you know, the different experience of the different fish species. And then you sort of evolve into what kind of destination you would like to go to next. And it's either a choice of going to target more permit in the Emirates, or going to target your bumphead parrotfish and so forth at Farquhar or Provolone, or going to experience, you know, more GTs at Cosmolita. So, yeah, the Seychelles is remote. It's wild. It's something we have to experience.
So, Gabe, that's amazing. And, you know, I've been lucky to experience it. And there's so much to it. Each island has its own flavor, you could say. With the type of fish, with how you can target them, with how the atoll is set up, with the accommodations, it's all very captivating. It's bucket list, especially for people from the States. It's so outside the realm of our normal type of fishing experience. It truly is. You guys have curated a one of a kind thing that, I mean, obviously is wildly popular. You talk to anybody who's gone there and they all say the sentiment is the same across the board, which is really cool. And it's a testament to not just the fishery itself, but it's a testament to how you guys run it. So you were one of the co-founding members of it. You're the managing director. You've obviously seen it progress over all these years, as you guys have opened up different atolls and developed the lodges, and not just that, but developed the fisheries themselves. You mentioned Wayne Haslov earlier in the podcast, and he was one of those original guides with you, and his stories were amazing of how you guys figured out how to fish for each of the different species and how that was all unlocked. So when you were talking about Pinoy, because you've got a lot of experience outside of the Seychelles too, and you know your time helping run Pinoy, you mentioned conservation was a big part of that operation. Does conservation play a role in how you guys operate Alphonse, or how Alphonse has kind of grown and changed over the years?
Yeah, so conservation is the keystone of our business. Now, you know, obviously in the early days, it wasn't so much. It was about experiencing these amazing places and fishing them. But, you know, all, you know, inevitably, you know, like time on the water gets replaced. You know, I can say that lust to catch as many fish as possible and to show the guests as many fish as possible kind of gets replaced with an experience of like growing into a role where you don't care so much about what you're catching, but more about how the guests are enjoying the trip. And no, inevitably, though, the guest won't remember his 50th bonefish, but he'll remember the different experiences, you know, the different experiences of different places, different things he learned while he was out in his destinations. And it was that realm of the unknown for me, in the sense that, you know, I knew that, you know, you can't just go out to these destinations and take a liverboard out there and fish it for your 10 or 15 weeks and then just like go back to the main island and forget about it for a year until you go back again. Now, you have to be responsible in the sense that you need to make sure these places are being taken care of. So, you know, over the years, you know, my mindset was, you know, would these places be as attractive for non-fly fishing people just to come and experience them, to walk the flats, to see what we're seeing, to experience sharks in shallow water, to see turtles up close and, you know, within inches of you, you know, to experience the amazing things that you see, both above the water and under the water. And, you know, over the years, and I've obviously always sort of questioned that. And in the early days, we were primarily a liverboard oriented operation, and I didn't believe that had as much credit as it should. I mean, I wouldn't say credit. I don't think it was. We should have been focused that way. I sense that, you know, in order to protect these places, we had to have a all year presence. Now, having an all year presence means that in order to do that, you need to have scientific work and a basis of why you would be there. And also, you need to listen to the science. You know, you need to know how it was when you took it over, or when your presence was started, and how you progress over the years. So we were fortunate enough that when we started looking at different destinations, that we were sitting liverboards to the IDC, which is the Island Development Company, which is a division of the Seychelles government, who were or still are the arm that runs the Outer Islands. They were open to the discussions of how, you know, these destinations can be developed in a responsible way, respectful way, but also at the same time, you know, obviously listening to conservation. So there is a non-profit organization called Island Conservation Society that had already been set up. And we kind of, you know, jumped on board with Island Conservation Society and us and IDC and started, building the destinations, i.e. the lodges. And, you know, with each one of these lodges, we set up a foundation. There is a donation from each and every person a nightly donation that comes to these islands. Those funds then go into a central account, which is then utilized for the rangers and the conservationists and the scientists, which are based annually, permanently, on these destinations, who do the monitoring and do the science. So there is an independent organization that actually monitors what's happening there. So through this sort of, you know, we were able to take over destinations like Farquhar, you know, Cosmito, Estove, Alphonse, and improve what was happening there. So, for instance, at Alphonse, when we got there, they were fishing 14 rods. There was no sort of regulations or guidelines about what can and cannot be done from a client perspective. So a client could do whatever they wanted when they got there. We sort of, you know, enforced guidelines on what our guests were allowed to do. And we reduced the rods, we reduced the pressure, we reduced the way in which we fished for the fish. We obviously put in place the Giant Valley acoustic telemetry study, the Milkfish acoustic telemetry study. So there was a lot of science that had gone into it. But over the years, the data which has come back has helped us, you know, and guide us into how to operate the IE, which areas do we close, which areas do we rotate, what is the carrying capacity. When I refer to carrying capacity, I mean the amount of people that can fish there at any one time for the amount of time they can do it. So we learned a lot of lessons. And, you know, we over the years, you know, through trial and error, we made changes. And we're happy to report that all the destinations, the fisheries are intact. Alphonse fishery, the fishing has got better. Farquhar fishing, the fishing has got better. Cosmopolitan, the fishing has remained the same as it was. Estove has been a challenge, but now thankfully, you know, we're back to four rods, and, you know, in a short amount of weeks, 8 weeks, and the fishing is back to where it was. You know, so you learn your lessons. But at the same time, you know, the reason why we're doing this is obviously we want to protect them. We want eyes and ears on location to prevent illegal fishing. And you must imagine that the southerly atolls are so close to Comores and different islands in the area that it's easy for commercial fishermen to come across and take whatever they want. And it was happening. So we've managed to work with the Seychelles government and stop this illegal fishing. It's poaching of turtles. It's poaching of sea cucumbers. It's netting of and line fishing for giant trevally and all sorts of species in shallow water. You know, mass sort of cultivation of fish. And through what we've done, you know, having this permanent presence, the fisheries are intact. And what it also does is that, you know, it aligns with the Seychelles minimum impact, maximum revenue sort of motto, i.e. their blue economy. Low impact, but maximum sort of revenue return. And so it's worked really well for them. And, you know, we're happy to report, you know, that these destinations are intact and they've been protected. And I know it's a cliche, as we say, they've been protected for our kids, but they really are.
No, honestly, that's what I respect most about you guys. You know, our motto at the Guides Association here is better business through conservation. So everything that we do revolves around our model of SEA. So science, education, then advocacy. So it starts with good science, then it goes to educating people based on the best available science, and then it, you know, is building advocates to go advocate for the things that they love based on those building blocks. So you guys have operated, Alphonse, on a very similar model. And it's so cool to see it be as successful as it is, because I think once people realize that it's not just a business, it's not just we found something really cool and put people through its paces, come experience it, wear it down, and we're going to milk this thing until we can't milk it anymore, and then it's done. The approach has been the exact opposite. The approach has been what we have is truly special. And, you know, what do we need to do to protect this so that it can stay this way? It's sustainable business, right? It's not just a kill charter that's going to take until the fishery stock has dwindled and then they don't have a business model anymore. So I think this resonates, one, with our listeners, but it resonates with all of us because we see that approach, and we're doing a similar thing here in the States with, you know, our saltwater fisheries here. We're trying to promote the best science, educate people on it, and then create advocates that are going to fight for this. So, you know, to tie everything together, what are some of the science-driven projects that you guys have done on Alphonse there that have impacted this? Like your work with the government, for example.
So yeah, we work with the RCS, which is the Island Conservation Society, which is a separate entity which does the conservation. We work with the arm of the government, which is the IDC, and they obviously hold the main leases, which we sublease from them, and we have, you know, really long leases, up to 75 years on these destinations. And so as a collaboration, we work together in making sure these destinations are preserved. And all of them have a very similar conservation ethos in the sense that every single person that comes out pays their conservation levy. We raise funds through various other avenues, auctions or fishing trips, donations, all sorts of stuff. And by doing that, we raise a really healthy sort of bundle of cash where we can which we can allocate to the science projects. So, you know, about 6 years ago, we initiated a discussion with Annie from UMass, and we then started the Giant Trevally acoustic telemetry tagging project. Now, it's very exciting for us because we didn't know very much about Giant Trevally, how they moved, whether they were truly resident. And, you know, the distance of the movements they were due to travel to feed, you know, how it would affect them when we caught them, you know, would and amortization, you know, death of these fish once we caught them, is the survival rates, and primal hunting areas they would focus their hunting or their feeding areas, just general scenario of how smart these fish were, by putting listening stations, which is a device which is underwater. I think we had over 100 of those 125 maybe even. I forget, I'm a bit rusty. We had them in the water. We acoustic telemetry tagged 80 giant trevally, and we have data, 5 years data on those fish. So we know exactly, you know, how far they moved, you know, what their feeding range was, the area where they sort of lived and moved, you know, mortality rate, and so forth. And what we also put in place is we did pit tags. So all the fish which we caught, we put a tiny, tiny little grain of rice tag just below the dorsal fin. And then we would then scan every single fish thereafter to see, you know, what our repeat catches would be. And, you know, the first 3 years, the repeat catches would be minimal, very, very few every single year. No, but as the years have progressed, whether those fish have become comfortable or not, we've started having more repeat catches. But in essence, you know, what we learned is that the mortality rate was very low because all 80 of those fish, bar two, I think it was, pinged the listening stations or underwater listening stations on numerous occasions until their batteries went flat. Generally, some batteries, it depended on what kind of listening device was inside them, what kind of device was inside them, but some of them had accelerator devices where, you know, they would consume the battery in a year and a half. Some didn't have the accelerator, you know, sharing what speed they were traveling at and so forth, that would last longer. And then obviously we slowly lost those giant trevally as the batteries did the battery life did die. But you know, obviously those giant trevally did live thereafter because we had little spaghetti tags in some of them and so forth. Sorry, little rice grain tags inside of them. So we could tell when we scanned them if they'd been caught, when they'd been caught, where they were caught before, what their size was before, and so forth. So we've learned a lot. I mean, you'll have to look into that project, the UMass information. It's been published. It's got, you know, all the information there, and you'll be able to see how exciting the data is. And on the basis of that data, we obviously, you know, we plan our season. We plan our movements of our guides and how they fish, and how, you know, respectful we need to be to certain areas. And it also entails the closing of certain areas. So, yeah, we're very proud of that project. You know, it's obviously the first one of its kind, you know, of its magnitude. And, yeah, very exciting stuff.
Did the work from that project give you guys any leverage with working with IDC to help protect the atolls?
Yeah, so absolutely. No, so all the information we've had, you know, it gives you more of an argument, or, you know, a better way of convincing them that, you know, this is the right thing to do, because inevitably, you know, it shows that catch and release fly fishing is way more sustainable than any other kind of conventional fishing. So, you know, from that basis, and they obviously see the numbers and obviously the amount of money and people that are coming through, and it's sustainable in the sense that the fish are always there, you know, so it definitely does motivate the discussion. You know, there is the Marine Protected Areas Act, which is in place now in the Seychelles, that's now going through the teething sort of stages of how now to implement the regulations. So, yes, it has helped. There's been numerous other scientific work that's done that's helped, you know, promote the sense of recreational fly fishing and sort of help in showing the world that, you know, fly fishing is part of a sustainable framework of activities you can offer these destinations, not only bird watching, diving, snorkeling, and all of the other stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's so cool to hear. I've gone through an arc myself as a conservationist and as an angler, where when I first started, we all obviously have this burning passion inside us to pursue these fish, right? So inherently, I think, well, I love them so much, that's enough for me to fight to protect them, right? But as I kind of grew in conservation within that realm, I realized that there's not really a readiness to protect or manage a species without some sort of reason for warranting the protection, be it financial, economic, cultural importance, whatever that reason might be. So it switched my perspective from realizing that it's not always just enough to go cry to lawmakers and game managers that, you know, this species should be protected because they're amazing. I love fishing for them and I want them to be around for my kids to fish for them. And that language oftentimes falls on deaf ears, right? So I've learned that you have to have something to establish the need to protect them, right? And science is the key to that, right? That data helps unlocks the life cycles and patterns, which then, you know, you can start to relate to how people are using them. And, you know, showing an economic value on a fish is a language that people in government understand, right? You know, money is sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, the language of getting things done. I get so excited about this GT research that you guys did. One, I feel so fortunate that I was there the season that this started. I got to be a part of putting pit tags in GTs and kind of the wonder and the mysteriousness of knowing that all this work that we're doing is going to lead to something. We don't know how it's going to show itself yet, but as this data comes in, something's going to come of this. So it's so cool to hear about how, you know, it's unfolded and been leveraged to help manage and protect that fishery. So we're on the cusp of doing something similar here in the States. We're initiating a first of its kind project for Jack Crevalle, which are, for all intents and purposes, a giant trevally in a different part of the world. They're every bit as nasty. They're every bit as powerful. They don't get quite as big, but, you know, outside of being in a slightly different habitat, they're every bit the fish that giant trevally are. So more people are keying into that in the States here, where it's becoming a more leaned upon fishery because people are realizing, like, holy shit, dude, these fish are amazing. They're aggressive. They fight like hell. You know, they'll bend a 12 weight right down into the butt. You'd fight in the same way that you would a giant trevally. Fish from the same way too. It's great. So, you know, we're doing this full science education and advocacy module on these fish because they, up until this point, they've been completely unregulated and unmanaged. So there's no protection for them whatsoever. And, you know, we see the importance of this species, not only culturally, but economically for a lot of these businesses that rely on a species that's this exciting to go target for their guests. So we're securing funding to do the same thing, 100 acoustic tags in several different zones, South Carolina, Eastern Florida, the Florida Keys, Louisiana, and Texas. I know Yako used to work out in the islands for many years, and he's now in Texas. And these Jack Crevalle are a big part of his program now. One of the cool things that he's tapped into. So we're going to be deploying these tags in all these different zones. They've got over 6 year battery life, so we're going to get over 6 years of data. We're working with Florida International University, the Jen Rehaj there, and then Marcus Dryman from the University of Mississippi, or Mississippi State University, excuse me. We have an awesome team putting this together, and that's going to be the base for this like full module that we're doing. So goal is get the science, then we can start to educate people about them. Once we've done all the education, then, you know, we've built out a bunch of people who can advocate for them, right? And that's where the meaningful change starts to come on our end, where we can see things like precautionary management go in for a species that we know is on the up and up. So before they ever get to a critical point in you know, their time, there's already guardrail regulations put in that help protect them so we can see something flourish and not get to the point of complete destruction before everyone's, you know, starting to try to fight for it. And, hearing about how you guys have run Alphonse and how you built it up to be what it is so cool. And I think it's such a cool model that really every business in the fishing industry should be using. Building that sustainable business that, you know, is not only good for you, but it's the reason people want to keep coming back there, right? Like, yeah. We try to convince people in the States here. We had a big fight in Louisiana to help get redfish regulations changed. And like, I understand that a lot of these conversations are nuanced. There's a lot of tradition, especially in a place like Louisiana, which the redfish, have you guys been there to fish for the redfish in Louisiana?
Yeah, I have. It's amazing. Venice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very cool. Culturally, it's cool. The fishery's unbelievable. It's an amazing place. So, like, trying to convince people that, you know, people come here from all over the planet to fish for these fish. The fishery is strong, but if it keeps getting chipped away at, if the fishing changes, people aren't going to want to show up, right? Like, if I'm having to spend a lot of money to go fish somewhere, like, I want to know that I'm in a place where I'm going to have a lot of opportunities, right? Catching is one thing. I've been on plenty of trips where I fish like an asshole and I don't catch a lot, but you know, the experience lies in, well, the experience just going out and targeting them. So it's like trying to convince people here that, you know, if the fishery is strong, people are going to keep coming back. If it's not, you're going to start to lose business. And I think you guys have captured that in such a cool way. And it's amazing how you've woven it into the DNA of what Alphonse is, at each of your different locations. And I think everybody's bearing witness to how successful it is. And it's truly great. We applaud you guys for how you've done it.
So you mentioned that, you say that very key word. I mean, the very key word in what we're doing is fight. Now, it is a fight, as you say. You know, you're fighting for, you know, these various different fish species. Now, I've caught Jack Crevalle. I've caught, you know, all the different Jack species on the west coast of Africa. You know, I'm involved in an amazing destination on the west coast of Africa called Gabon, to the Koma Lodge. And we have an incredible Jack fishery. And I've caught them, and they fight pound for pound as hard as giant trevally do. You know, some of them, those big guys, even fight harder. You know, obviously utilizing different aspects of, you know, river flow and all sorts. But no, they really are an exciting species. Now, I think that, you know, that word fight comes into play in numerous different scenarios. You know, it is about that. But the fight starts with the people that are fishing for them. So they need to be, you know, I believe that you need to be responsible in the sense that choose your guides who are making a difference. The guys which are doing the research, no matter how big or small, all the organizations that are doing the research, no matter how big or small the effort that they're doing, any little bit of data, i.e. the Jack Crevalle, if you see, you know, through this telemetry acoustic study that the migratory rate routes are changing, or the feeding habits are changing, or you're not getting a return of these jacks and so forth, is a key indicator of, you know, there's an issue, you know, and that could stem from, you know, all over various different issues, you know, obviously water clarity, so water quality and all sorts. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, the organizations and the guides which are making the effort to put back, to give back, to fish responsibly, to rather focus on the experience versus catching as many as you can with and treating the fish in a bad way. No, you should avoid those kind of people. You know, the people that are there and believe that, you know, it isn't a endless sort of supply of all different fish species. We have to be responsible. And I think that, you know, off the back of that, you'll learn a lot, number one. But number two, you'll also, you know, understand that there's so many different scenarios that come into play with those jacks. You know, we learned with the giant trevally, you know, through learning through the science, all sorts of new things that have now sparked new interest in, you know, and different scientific work, you know, and you know, why, for instance, we had at Alphonse, we had giant trevally that we called the pits that would live around the dock, but, you know, they're obviously habituated trevally in a sense. And they would, without any notice, they will disappear. and they would get pinged in the northern part of St. Francois, which is 7 or 8 nautical miles away. And they would disappear, and they would return in a day. And no one even knows why they would do that. Same thing happens in Farquhar. We have habituated giant rallies that hang around the dock there, and all of a sudden they'll disappear for a week. And no one knows why, and they're gone. There are no giant trevally on the flats in any way. It's just a mass exodus. So, you know, all these little different things that spark interest will obviously, once the science evolves and continues to evolve, will sort of unfold in a way that you'll learn so much about these giant trevally and be able to protect them more. I mean, yeah, obviously we believe we're right in the beginning of giant trevally conservation. And I think that, you know, you have to start somewhere, and you know, learning and hearing that you guys are going to be doing something, you know, in the USA and Texas and so forth is just amazing. Yeah, I'm excited to hear about it.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's kind of the way that we look at you guys and what you've done with giant trevally. The exact same approach, the exact same motivation. We're just trying to be as forward thinking as we can be. They're an amazing species to target. And, you know, everyone's heard of giant trevally. You guys have been so masterful with your marketing. And I think just the fish itself lends itself so greatly to captivating people's attention. They really are truly the gangsters of the flats. They're so powerful. They're so aggressive. They're so visceral. They're an amazing species. So, you know, jack crevalle here in the States, they have all those same characteristics, right? But they haven't gotten the same attention or amount of love. And I think people are starting to key into that now. People are realizing that, man, we have a species over here that we can target that kind of scratches that same itch. Obviously, the environments that you fish for them, and they're different, right? It's not full on like flats fishing in gin clear water. One of the biggest things that happened to me while I was out there, I have several stories from being out in the Seychelles, some humiliating, others just completely awe inspiring. And one of them was, you know, most of the day we spent giant trevally fishing. One of the anglers I had, husband wife combo, they were so great. We were just getting shots. There was just a lot of activity with giant trevally. And at the very end of the day, we hadn't converted on any fish yet, mostly because I was not putting the angler in the correct position to have the best shot. That was part of my learning curve as a guide. But, you know, at the very end of the day, we were up on by Tiger Flat. So this is on the southwest side of the atoll. And we pull up onto this flat, and it's a nice pushing tide, so water's starting to fill up. We're in very shallow water. I get up on the flat, and we've got enough water that we can push up onto the flat. So I get a good ways onto the sand, and you can see for miles. It's part of what makes the Seychelles so amazing. So we're looking back to the edge of the flat where it just drops off deep into the lagoon, and we see these three massive shapes come over the edge and come up onto the flat. And at first, I thought shark. I didn't say it out loud because I learned my lesson calling stuff out too quickly and then being wrong and having your anglers look back at you and be like, you're an idiot. It's not a shark. So we saw these three figures come on, reposition the boat, push a little ways, and we were maybe like 150 yards away from them. But you could see them clear as day. I mean, this is over shallow white sand. So we had pushed and pushed and pushed and gotten close enough that the angler, Christian, I had could throw a cast. And he threw it maybe 60 feet away. And in my head, I was thinking, what are you doing? Like, that's nowhere near that. And he obviously knew much more about these fish than I did at the time, because he knew they could still see it from there. So sure enough, he slowly started moving it through the water. And as soon as the first fish shot and started to get that little wiggle, they get that little burst of energy and they go just a little bit faster in the direction, not full on coming for it, but it's like they heard something, they saw something, they're interested. And it just got that wiggle and started going a little bit faster. The other two followed it. And as they got closer, they picked up speed. And before we knew it, unfolding before us was like a full on competition between these massive animals, as big as anything as big as any fish I'd ever seen. When we were on Farquhar, we landed a 131 centimeter G. My boat partner caught it. It was an unbelievable experience. I got to hold that fish. I felt it. I saw it. The shoulders. It was a beast. These three fish were bigger than that. I don't want to put a number on it because I don't want to be an asshole and over-exaggerate, which I often do with stories, especially fish stories. But they were big. And so one of these fish ate. He hooked it. Complete blackout elation. Excitement. Electricity. You know, all the failed attempts earlier in the day. And he actually hooked this fish. And now it's got nowhere to go. We're 150 yards up into this flat. So I'm like, oh my God, you got this fish. Just wrench your drag all the way down, make him handstand. It was such a dumb rookie mistake. This fish was so much more powerful than his Hatch 11 reel could handle. And no knock on Hatch. I have my preference for what I use for saltwater reels. Hatch makes wonderful reels, but he had tightened it too tight. And it wasn't even the reel that malfunctioned. As this fish was pulling line, I mean, he had the reel maxed out and it still looked like it was just free flowing off the reel. You couldn't see the spokes. It was moving so fast. And I thought, holy shit, Christian, like lock that thing down. You got to stop this fish. Cause if he gets to the end, I can't start the motor. We're in too shallow a water. It's going to take me too long to push. He's going to go wrap up in coral and this fish is going to be gone. And it had pulled so tight on this line, it just broke the fly line in the belly. So it made a snap that sounded like a gunshot. His rod came apart in four pieces. His rod didn't break. It just separated each section from itself. It sounded like a gunshot. We were all like, we all kind of covered our hands by our head. We were so shocked by it. And we couldn't figure out until after the fact that once we brought his line in, it had just stretched the line so tight, it snapped in the belly of the fly line. I triple wrapped this line around my hand, trying to pull line off the reel. For the life of me, I'm not a weak individual. I'm not going to say I'm the strongest guy on the planet, but you know, I can put a little muscle behind something if I need to. I couldn't pull line off this reel. And it was the first moment I had that was like, holy shit, this is a different type of animal. So people are starting to realize that here in the States. Now, we don't have the same scenarios that you guys have in the Seychelles. It's not often that you can find these crystal clear flats like I was on for that story, for example. But people are starting to tap into the fact that Jack Crevalle are every bit as powerful, every bit as nasty, every bit as fun to target. So it's cool to see this up-and-coming fishery, and we want to get ahead of it. We realize their value. So now the onus is getting the science and starting to prove that value. Educate everyone about it, and then build an army of advocates who are willing to go to hell and back to protect them and make this a premier fishery for everybody in the world to enjoy, right? You know, same thing with redfish, same thing with any species that we try to do. And I just think it's so cool. It's like standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, we see what you guys have done, and it sets a remarkably good example for the rest of the industry, and it's part of what makes you guys such figures, not just in the fly fishing industry, but in the fishing industry in general, right? Like building this to do it the right way, to be sustainable, to protect the resource first, and then people are going to keep coming, which is going to make the business even better. So it really is special to hear your stories about the Seychelles, to hear your stories about giant trevallies, you especially as an individual being, you know, as involved as you are. It's so cool drawing on your knowledge. And it has been an absolute joy having you on. Any last words you want to squeak in? I know we're eventually going to have you on for another podcast because content is another thing I would love to talk about. You're very savvy and creative with the camera too. Some of the film work you've done has been amazing, and that's a whole nother can of worms to open that we could talk about for many hours. But yeah, any closing remarks?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I can relate to that story. You know, I can tell you a thousand stories about big fish, but I'll tell you one. So it was midway into my guiding career, and I'd seen many big fish over the years. And this particular day, we had some massive fish come around. Anyway, so we hooked this fish. And for some strange reason, I had a gentleman who had told me a story about a massive bonefish that he had hooked in Bahamas and fought it for an hour and lost it. And he called the number. I can't remember how big it was. And I thought, well, maybe a little bit of bullshit there. But, you know, it wouldn't be surprised me if the guy mentioned it was 20 pounds. But anyway, so in the same conversation, he said, listen, where should I keep this roll of spare braid? So, like, well, that's quite strange that you have spare braid. But anyway, just put it in your backpack. You probably won't need it, but just put it in your backpack. I've never respooled to that stage. I had never respooled a reel before on the flats. So we're out in the flats, and we end up hooking this massive fish. And I've got him in the skiff, and it's at a low tide where I'm pushing the skiff over the shallow areas. And then as it gets to deeper water, I'm then running the engine, chasing, we're getting line back. And then we hit shallow area again. I'm pushing the skiff over the shallow water. And that happens for three times, and for long periods of time. At 31 minutes, I looked at my watch. We've been in the fight at 31 minutes. We still were fighting the fish swimming with the other fish and was hooked. We then, about 2 or 3 minutes later, the school of fish that I was swimming with had left, and we were fighting the fish by itself. And we got into a shallow area, and it did what we call the flip. So it kind of like flipped in the flats where it goes, does a bit of a handstand and flips over. And you kind of know that at that stage, you're generally not going to have as much power to run long distances to break you off. He's got to start looking for structure. So you kind of like want to get a little bit closer to him and sort of, if there's any structure, you can at least work around it or get in the water, take that line off and so forth. So we get this fish and it's done now. It's done. So I get it into a shallow area. I jump into the skiff. I take the anchor. I walk out, 25 meters. I put the anchor down, and I run my hand down the line to get the leader. And I get the leader, and the fish sees me. It heads off again. Now I'm going, goodness me, okay, I don't know how fast it's going to go. It's a hell of a speed. But I decide, okay, let me start making my way back to the boat just in case. So I start making my way back to the boat. I grab the anchor. As I grab the anchor, I see the backing not go past me. So now I say, okay, this is another run. So I start running back towards the boat. By the time I get 25 meters, by the time I get to the boat and throw the anchor in, I hear an almighty snap. Wah! And the guest falls backwards into the boat. And I think, shit, the fly line's parted or something's broken. And I look at him and he's standing there, he's holding the reel and all the backing's gone. Everything's gone. And he was fishing with a Gulfstream riptide, so it's probably a little bit small for what he was doing, but it still held 250 yards of 50 pound. Now, in a period of, call it, not even a minute, he was spooled 250 yards of backing. And at that moment, I didn't know what he said. Oh my goodness, that's the biggest GT I've ever hooked. But, obviously he reached into his backpack to find the new spool of braid and expected us to load it up and go and hook another one of those. And I was like, okay, a little bit of a reality check. But anyway, obviously moving on from that, all these big guys are old, so they've been around the flats for a long time. I'm not talking about the angler, but talking about the GT. And, so obviously by protecting these places and, you get to experience, have more interactions with these big guys that have been on for many, many years. And they aren't scared to come in the flats and they haven't been caught or, in different ways and they haven't been treated badly in a sense. And obviously all the bait and all the bait fish and bone fish are still in the flats there for them to come in and feed on when they do come on. Yeah. And, I can't wait, saying that and comparing it to Jack Revelle. I mean, as you say, Jack Revelle are very similar. They're the same kind of fish. It's just that we catch them in different scenarios. But Joe, it's been amazing chatting to you. Amazing chatting about fishing and reconnecting with you after a long time off the island. But I just want to say that Alphonse, you did really well, and everyone was very impressed about how you talk about your inabilities. But I can tell you right now, your inabilities were very limited. Your abilities were super exceed all of that. And, we appreciated you coming out to the Seychelles and fishing with us, even though it was only for a year. But you know, the Seychelles isn't for everybody. You know, we generally have learned a lot of lessons in the sense that we now employ a lot of younger guys in the sense that, you know, it's the longest season, one of the longest seasons. And, you know, it's an 8-month season, and you know, obviously really hard on people that, you know, one, you do numerous seasons. Generally, we say if you can make 2 seasons, you're a proper guide and Seychelles guy. You know, you know, generally we hope that our guides will stay for longer than 3 seasons, because obviously, you know, we're only getting something out of them after 3 seasons as they learn the different scenarios, places, tides, and fish species. But yeah, it truly is a great place, and you know, even with all the years on the flats, I learn something new every time I step foot there, and that's what keeps me fighting. You know, here comes that word again, the fight. And yeah, it's changed from a want to protect it because of the fishery to a want to protect it because I love it so much, in the sense of taking people there and showing them, you know, this amazing destination and ecosystem above and below water. And it's that fight that keeps us going and making sure that, you know, we can help in any which way in assisting in any scientific research in other places, or, you know, scientific research in our destinations. But yeah, it obviously has to start with the guests and the wonderful people that come out to these destinations, who book us because we are responsible, who book us because they know that we fought the fight, and they inevitably, you know, they know that they're putting their money in the right place, in the sense that it is, you know, contributing to protecting these places. And hopefully, you know, that the USA is the same. You know, I do know that you know, Americans are very well traveled, and they do respect fisheries, and they do want to, you know, obviously give back. And their choices are normally the right choices, and the right people, the right guys that do the good stuff.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on. This has been so much fun. We'll catch up again, because I want to pick your brain about all the cool movies you've made and been a part of. I know you've traveled to so many different places around the world, the Golden Masseira stuff. You've done several lifetimes worth of cool fishing adventures, you know, packed into the life you're still living, which I think is so admirable and awesome. So another time, another place, we're going to connect on that. But thank you so much for coming on today. We truly appreciate it. It's been awesome. We love it, and we look forward to the next time. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Yeah, look, we do have a couple more movies coming out. We've got a new Farquhar short clip coming out, a short movie coming out. We've got a new Cosmolito movie coming out, and then we also have another movie called Trigger Happy, which is about, you know, a very important guide to us who's come through the ranks, called Yusuf. He's the only Bangladeshi fisherman in the world, or guide in the world. So yeah,
oh, yeah,
look out for them, and yeah, please do take a look when you see them.
I got to reconnect with Yusuf when I went out to Farquhar, which was special, because he was one of the guys who kind of helped train me and took me under his shoulder when I was out at Alphonse. So it was that's cool to see that he's kind of getting his come up and getting that attention, because he was really cool actually out on Farquhar with the triggerfish. I'm looking forward to seeing that. That's going to be cool. Appreciate you, and
thanks,
yeah, keep fighting the good fight. We'll be in touch. Okay,
excellent. Bye.